So with respect to, you know, expectations for us, it's to continue to build on what we've built. So as I mentioned earlier, we're a team in transition. And, you know, we're all about bringing in young, dynamic, athletic players who can play the style of play that we want to play. You know, and I think at the end of the day, if we continue to do that, you know, we're going to build a team that's going to compete on a yearly, nightly, and yearly basis.
He doesn't know how to put those words together in a sentence. That's Mark Eversley, your titular Bulls general manager. He's not even sure how he's supposed to fake this BS. But that's what he said on the night of the draft, right? Wasn't that post-draft after they drafted Noah Essengay of France, who might or might not play for them? But at least they got a guy who can order the wine. I think that's what's really, it's really important. The guy from France can do that for you. Welcome and welcome back, Steve Rosenblum and Mike Esposito. We are in for sort of Mully and Hobb, but now Rahimi and Harris. And we're just a pregame show for Trash Panda.
That's it.
Adam Studzinski.
We're all the pregame show
for
Trash
Panda.
He's
warming up in the bullpen. He's about to finally bring you the headliner today. We've been a long, long undercard for Trash Panda. And the reason we brought you Mark Eversley is not to torture you. Although it probably is. It would not be above us, right?
It wouldn't be beneath us,
that's
for sure.
It wouldn't be beneath us either, yeah. But the Mully and Haw Show guests join us on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, Aturo.com. We welcome to the show Drew Stevens of The Bigs. He covers the Bulls for The Bigs. So let's start here, Drew. Thank you for joining us on this holiday weekend. Can you explain why the Bulls want players that good teams don't want and teams that play these players? Bulls want players that played less for good teams. Why do the Bulls covet these guys like Josh Giddey and Okoro and God knows who else?
Well, first off, thank you guys for having me on. I think that's the million-dollar question that every fan, every media member is trying to figure out. What is it in Arturis' and Mark's past experience in front offices that has led them to believe that this is the best way to go about a roster rebuild, where they are prioritizing young players with experience over draft capital? They are essentially taking more bites at the trade market for ones that are bruised and more expensive than the bites at the apple in the draft that could net them, you know, cost-controlled players with more upside. So I think that Arturis and Mark are, you know, they tell us that they're trying to shrink the timeline. They're looking for guys who kind of fit this latest roster mold that, you know, pretends to be built around or built with Josh Giddey in mind. So you want guys who can run, who can play some defense, who know how to cut and play out in transition. But I think they essentially are making things much more harder on themselves by not valuing draft capital as much as they are players with experience. And I worry for Bulls fans that they're going to be in for a longer ride than Arturis and Mark even are asking for in terms of the patience that they want fans to show them. I think they're actually making the timeline longer going about it this way.
Well, there's no doubt, Drew, and I mean, they just drafted an 18-year-old in Essengay, but, you know, you make the trade, you get rid of Lonzo for Okoro, they re-sign Trey Jones. Do you think, especially with the depth that they have at the guard position and figuring you're going to re-sign Giddey, that another trade is in the offing?
I think they're looking to make some. You know, we've heard reports that they're taking calls, maybe even making calls about Kobe White and Ayo Dosunmu, Nikola Vucevic as well. But as has been the case with this front office, they sit on guys a little bit too long where they end up bleeding their value. And essentially these guys become more valuable to the Bulls than they would be to other teams around the league. So they can try, but I don't think that they're is anything, you know, with any good money to put on in terms of something happening here before the season starts. Now, I will say, with the news of Jonas Valanciunas maybe considering a return to the EuroLeague instead of going to join Nikola Jokic out in Denver, maybe there's an opportunity where Nikola Vucevic and the Bulls can agree to a buyout, and maybe he goes to back up his buddy in Denver. But again, I don't know. You know, Al Horford is still on the market. I'm not sure if Denver would value Vucevic more than they would a player of Horford's, you know, abilities and championship experience.
Drew Stevens joins us. He writes about the Bulls for the Bigs, thebigs.com, bigsus.com, and you need to check it out. He's as confounded by some of this stuff as we are, and we were discussing wherever this might go, and you made an excellent point about the fact that nobody seems to get less out of its player trades than the Bulls. The fact that you can trade Alex Caruso and not get a first-round draft pick out of Oklahoma, which has so many, and the fact that you can make these kind of deals and not get first-round picks and appear to not even try, but you're trying to get some of the worst or descending players from the draft 5 years ago, is I need someone to either make it stop or make it make sense. And I don't know how to do this. I don't know where it goes. The Bulls did change stuff. They got faster, and they still were a play-in team, and they still got kicked in the rocks by Miami because that's what they do, and that's all that AK, the Prince of the Play-In, can do. Why would anybody have faith other than a insane Reinsdorf, if that's what it is, anybody that a guy who just wants to fill the building? I mean, why would any Bulls fan have faith that this is going to turn around?
Well, I would say that the faith is not in the front office. It's more so with Matas Buzelis and Noah Essengay. That's where the faith lies. And in reading between the lines of Mark Eversley's media availability after the draft, it seems as if that's where their faith is too, because they don't really have a plan to acquire a superstar talent. So they're banking on their internal development to do so. And with respect to how little they've gotten back for that team that they put together that had, you know, that great run one time, one half of a season 3 years ago.
Yeah.
They've turned Alex Caruso, DeMar DeRozan, Zach LaVine, and Lonzo Ball into Isaac Okoro, Josh Giddey, Kevin Huerter, Trey Jones, Zach Collins, control of their future first round picks, Noah Essengay, cash, Chris Duarte, more cash, and Lachlan Obrich. So it really is one of those things where, you know, you look at the Lonzo Ball trade and you look at the Alex Caruso trade, like on the face of it, the trades, you know, you can maybe squint your eyes and say, okay, this is okay. I see the reasoning behind this. But when you kind of weigh that against maybe what they could have gotten from OKC, given that Josh Giddey was essentially about to become a sixth man off the bench, he needed to be paid. He did not have a good playoff showing, which caused the Thunder to want to bring him off the bench. And then with Lonzo Ball and Isaac Okoro, you have to look at what was speculated to be on the table for the Bulls last season, when it's been speculated that the Grizzlies offered a first-round pick for the price of taking on Marcus Smart's contract. So these deals, like, in and of themselves are okay until you look at what they could have gotten had they acted quicker on the players who have value around the league. And again, it just goes back to how they've bled value from their best players on a routine basis since they've, you know, kind of been in this position the last 3 years.
Some of the draft night stuff from Mark Eversley, it included the idea that we're, because the idea of the East being all broken because every important player is hurt and nobody knows who's going to play with Giannis. And Orlando seized on it. Atlanta seized on it. Detroit was coming. And Boston's going to, they're going to blow up. New York fired its coach because that wasn't good enough. And you saw, and Halliburton was a star that AK decided he wasn't going to draft and doesn't need now that kind of player because he wants to get guys nobody else wants. But Mark Eversley made the comment that we're taking the long view when he was faced with the idea or hit with the question of the East being so winnable now, so open. And they're taking the long view, and or he said that. And meanwhile, at the end of the season, AK says we're trying to shrink the timeline. So which is it? Do these guys know each other? Do they work in the same office? Can somebody introduce these guys?
It is confounding. It's confounding. You hit the nail right on the head. And if you are taking the long approach to this, if you are willing to be more patient than you were when you first kind of tore down that initial roster build and brought in Vooch and Caruso and DeMar and Lonzo Ball, why are you not valuing draft picks more? Like, you want to have more bites at the apple, especially given the way that we know they're not going to go into the luxury tax. So you want to have more cost-controlled players. You want to have guys who you can take upside swings on like they just did with Essengay. It really is confusing. And their plan right now does really seem to hinge on Bouzelis or Essengay really hitting and popping enough to become the superstar that this franchise hasn't had in quite some time.
Hey, Drew, we could do the front office all day, and I'm sure we all have the same thoughts on it. So I'm going to actually ask you, like, what can Bulls fans expect from Essengay? I know he's only 18, but I know a lot of people have surely not seen any of the European basketball that he's played. And what, you know, as part two of that is, what do you expect to see year two from Matas?
So what fans can expect from Essengay is, you know, somebody who is very athletic, who's long, can play defense, has a good motor, but he's also pretty raw. I would be surprised if he played any meaningful minutes next year, especially the first half of the season as he grows and adapts to not only being in the NBA, but just being in America in general. But there is some hope there for him that he kind of has the foundation and the willingness and drive to become one of the better players in the league here, you know, maybe in another 3-4 years. With Matas, man, the sky feels like it's the limit for him just because of how much of a sponge he is, how much he wants to learn the game, learn from his teammates, even learn from opponents. His work ethic, what we saw from him the second half of the season was really phenomenal. And he kind of embodies the hope of the fan base right now. He is the person that they're looking to pop in a way that this team can maybe break that decade drought of not having won a playoff series.
Drew, we appreciate you taking time on the holiday for joining us, talking Bulls, as unappetizing as that might be. You've done a wonderful job of laying stuff out. Look forward to talking to you in the future.
Hey, I appreciate you guys. You guys have a wonderful fourth.
You too. Be safe. Drew Stevens of the Bigs, talking Bulls here. We're going to take a break. Speaking of basketball, there was a famous basketball player.
Yes.
In the movie Airplane. It came out 45 years ago this week, and you didn't know who should have been that player, who was originally approached, who was supposed to be that role.
I still do not. You haven't
and
told me yet.
You may not believe who is considered who they hope to get instead of Robert Hayes to play Ted Stryker.
Okay.
I don't know any of this. I got a whole bunch of things about Airplane because it's the most wonderful movie, and I want to share that with you. And the red zone is for loading and unloading, and the white zone is for... If you recall that movie,
the man and woman trading the red zone. Don't give me that white zone bleep, Betty, right?
Uh-huh.
That was a real husband and wife.
Okay.
That did that. All right, take a break. When we come back, more sports talk in the movies, because that's who we do. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Okay, boys, let's get some pictures.
Classic cut. Leaving home out on the from Airplane, released 45 years ago this week.
An all-timer.
And we bring that up because it's an all-time movie, and our producer, Tyler Farengel, with a massive chasm in his cultural zeitgeist, had no idea, never heard of it, never
age
knew
gap.
Of it, doesn't know what happened, doesn't know what Airplane is. Well, it's a big thing that flies in the sky.
He's flown on an airplane, yes.
It was pitched. They did... the Abraham Zucker and Abrahams, the Abraham Brothers and Zucker... had done Kentucky Fried Theater in L.A. I had seen that in L.A. It was spectacular. It was funny. It was exactly...
local comic theater.
Right. And they had an idea to write a movie, and they'd found a movie from 40 years ago in the 1950s. There was a real... that was that movie. They spoofed a real movie, like Zero Hour or whatever it was called. And they had all the serious guys. And they just decided to spoof it. And there was every joke. There was a joke every 2 seconds. Because that's the way Kentucky Fried Theater was. And one of the all-time great scenes in Kentucky Fried Theater and live theater is one I can't describe now. I'm sorry I'm bringing it up. But it involved a marital aide in a courtroom scene. And asking if they're familiar with the... no, I can't even say it. I can't do that.
Stop, hold.
License. Anyways, Airplane featured Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Famously, yes, absolutely.
That's not who Zaz wanted. Zaz, by the way, Abraham Zucker, right?
Yep, I get you.
The guys who created this thing, who, by the way, sold it to Paramount, on the idea, they pitch. Everything is about a pitch, right? In Hollywood, mm-hmm. You're starting to sell a creative idea.
Yep.
The briefest, the better. It doesn't matter whether the idea is good. Do you remember an old movie called Panic in Needle Park?
No.
And it was when the heroin, at one point, heroin had spiked. And it was pitched to a studio as Romeo and Juliet on dope. On heroin. Romeo and Juliet on heroin.
Okay.
Because it was so brief.
Uh-huh.
And studio executives of zero vision could say that to their friends at cocktail parties, and they knew they had a slogan for it, right? Romeo and Juliet on heroin.
Yeah.
So what Zaz did was they sold it to Paramount based on this pitch. Animal House in an Airplane. And it was.
It was.
Right?
Accurate, yes. And Animal House was probably the biggest thing in movies at that time, right?
So, who should have been there? Who should have been in the cockpit instead of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? Who did they want first?
Now, you're saying it's another basketball player?
No, I'm saying, but it's another famous athlete.
It's a famous athlete, not a basketball player, that they wanted to play the Kareem part before Kareem.
Uh-huh. In the cockpit.
I mean, I truly don't know. I'm going to guess only because I know he did acting. Is it Jim Brown?
No, that's not a bad thought. Pete Rose.
No, get out of here.
They did. They wanted Pete Rose. They were going to have Pete Rose in the cockpit. What they were going to do, I don't know. I never saw the script. Pete Rose is going to be there. And scheduling problems prevented Pete Rose from doing that. So they turned to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and they offered him $30,000. 45 years ago.
Uh-huh.
That was a lot. It seemed like a lot of money then, right? And he said, I need $5,000 more. So he could purchase this jazz collection he'd had his eye on. And Kareem's house had a fire and he had an extensive jazz collection.
I have read about that, yes.
And Kareem was never a guy that opened himself up to... too much. He was not allowed. He wasn't going to allow people to see him. So it was really a surprise when he shows up in this cockpit. And with a smirk, he plays Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as Murdoch. And this, if Pete Rose had said yes, we wouldn't have had one of the most talked about scenes. Here it is.
Tell your old man to drag Walton in the near up and down the court for 48 minutes.
Hey, the little kid comes in. You're Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
You're Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
I'm Roger Murdoch.
Yeah.
Says, I'm a co-pilot.
He's right here. Uh-huh. Says Roger Murdoch. And he goes, my dad says you don't try unless it's a playoffs. And that's when he utters that great line. You know, and he grabs the kid by the...
Oh, so good.
So the movie features... The movie features Robert Hayes as...
Stryker. Yep, yeah. The main character.
He was so far down the list.
I don't know the list.
You know who they wanted first?
I don't.
David Letterman.
Get out of here.
David Letterman. And he auditioned.
Really?
And he didn't want the part, but he auditioned because he had a good relationship, or the Abraham Zucker and Zucker had a relationship with David Letterman, and David Letterman, oh, okay, I'll do. He auditioned to be Ted Stryker.
Wow. I could see him doing that. The same comic ideas, I guess, whatever, the same, you know, temperament, whatever.
So who, and again, this is in, say, the movie came out 45 years ago, so figure the time.
Yep.
Who else would you want to be Ted Stryker if you're Abraham Zucker and Zucker?
So if you're thinking about young...
Late 70s
comics, I mean, anyone from that Animal House thing certainly would be in there.
Or SNL.
SNL, yeah. Bill Murray.
He auditioned. They considered him and Chevy Chase.
Uh-huh.
And Fred Willard.
Fred Willard. Now, that would have been interesting.
Here's what really surprised me in learning this. Fred Willard was a guy who was a star of all the mockumentaries, right? All of the spectacular Christopher Guest mockumentaries, right? Best in Show, For Your Consideration. Mm-hmm. And he and Catherine O'Hara, they were just, it was wonderful. But he didn't get the airplane humor.
He didn't get it.
He didn't get the humor.
Is he not, and I'm blanking, is he not the station manager and Anchorman?
Yes.
Burgundy, he'll say whatever you put on that teleprompter.
That's right. Yes. And I didn't know that Sigourney Weaver auditioned for... Sigourney Weaver and Shelley Long were both auditioned for Julie Haggerty's part.
Okay.
And I didn't realize Julie Haggerty was a theater actress. That's where she came from. They got, because she seems so wonderful there, mm-hmm. and she's apparently as nice. She's as nice in person as she was on film in that film. That even when Robert Hayes screwed up a line, she would say, "Oh, I'm sorry."
When he was sweating, hoses of sweat,
and one of the other, if you're. All the many scenes from Airplane, one of the best, one of the classics, is Beaver Cleaver's mom.
Yeah.
Right?
Speaking jive, yep.
Right. Excuse me, stewardess, I speak jive.
Uh-huh.
Which is hysterical. But you know who they wanted for that?
I have no clue.
It fits the same. Harriet Nelson from Ozzie and Harriet.
Now, I never watched that. I never even saw reruns of that show. That's not, I'm not familiar
Harriet
with
Harriet Nelson was,
I know who she
know,
is.
Yeah, Ozzy was everybody, you know, everybody's dad.
Yep. And Ricky Nelson,
the irrepressible
yep.
Ricky Nelson. Yep. And Harriet, America's mom.
And 90s kids will appreciate the grandsons of Miss Nelson. The Rockers Nelson from the early 90s. Do you remember this?
I do not.
The blonde, long-haired Nelson brothers. Gunner and something else Nelson. They had one huge song in like 1990 or 91. They were part of the hair bands.
You know, recently I've been thinking about Ricky Nelson's, or Rick Nelson when he became a Garden Party, the song.
Okay.
And the miserable experience, and then trying to explain it. And explain it to people, and like, wow, that was okay. Rick Nelson doing that. And anyways, the mom, the real life mom, Harriet Nelson, was supposed to be saying, "Excuse me, stewardess, I speak jive." So some of the classic parts of that movie are the serious actors in this comedy.
Yep.
They included, most notably, Leslie Nielsen, who went on to make a career out of all these movies, right? And the bombs bursting, a bunch of bombs in the air.
It's Enrico Palazzo.
Yeah. But he was the one, the famous, "Surely you jest."
Yeah.
"I don't jest.
Surely you can't be serious."
"I am serious, and don't call me Shirley."
I still use the Lloyd Bridges, "I picked the wrong week" lines all the time.
Well, he didn't get it. He didn't get the jokes. Here's a serious actor like Robert Stack.
Robert Stack, sure. Unsolved Mysteries.
And Leslie Nielsen and Lloyd Bridges didn't get the joke. And then Jim Abraham said, "Lloyd, we are the joke." This yes. whole movie is the joke.
It's the whole thing. Pick the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
And Peter Graves initially.
Peter Graves,
yeah. Right? He was.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And it's particularly one of the great Peter Graves scenes. I don't know if you'd make it, how people would feel about it today when you watch the movie, right? When
Joey,
you ever seen a grown man naked?
Uh-huh.
Joey, you ever been in a Turkish prison? That kind of, I don't know if you could make that today. Give it. I don't know if you could say it. I don't know how it would be received. But back then, Peter Graves initially dismissed it. "I don't want anything. That's disgusting crap." That was his phrase. That was his quote. "It's disgusting crap."
You like movies about gladiators?
He gave the script to his family and friends, who found it hilarious.
Oh,
and that
man.
Convinced him to do it.
Well, and there's no question that a lot of the stuff that got, you know, Blazing Saddles, Airplane, some of the 70s non-PC stuff, I mean, there's no way it would be made today. There's no way.
Mm. The other thing we want to discuss, that we loved Airplane, and we were trying to, I mean, it's useless to try to explain all this to Tyler Farengel, our producer, but we lost Mr. Blonde yesterday.
Yes.
He was 67. Michael Madsen was found dead, cardiac arrest in his Malibu home. And he was one of the Reservoir Dogs. I'm trying to explain this to Tyler after he tried to BS me about knowing who this guy was. And of all of the gore, of all the violence, of all the stuff you've seen splattered all over Quentin Tarantino movies, Michael Madsen was part of probably the greatest, the most notable.
Doing the dance again.
This song.
And it's the first, too. It's the literal first Tarantino movie.
Yes.
For those that love Tarantino, and I know, you know, we tease Tyler a little bit. You know, there's an age gap, obviously, but a classic movie, right? And the best, you know, known scene in that movie.
And he's dancing around, dress clothes, and he looks very smooth in doing this. And then he slices off the ear.
Yeah.
And it's an iconic movie scene, but I will argue it's the greatest, most notable Tarantino scene. I love the opening of Reservoir Dogs
in
the diner.
Where
we kind of meet Steve Buscemi as Mr. Pink. I want to be Mr. Blonde. I mean, why can't I be Mr. Blonde? You're Mr. Pink.
Yep.
Toby. Who the? Toby. See, we pulled from that movie. Brett Lyons used to produce Saturday Suckage. One of many people getting run through here.
Yes.
Brett Lyons put together a opening for a caller instead of a guest.
That's right, the Toby Open.
Uh-huh. And that's where it came from, the whole Toby thing. But Michael Madsen's sister, Virginia Madsen.
Yep.
I mean, everybody, anybody who knew what you were, Michael Madsen was cool. You saw him in Kill Bill Volume 1. He played Bud. He did not survive, but he was certainly a character. And his sister, now I can't, where is it?
Virginia was in Sideways, right? Was that
the
Valley wine movie, right? Which was good with Paul Giamatti in it. But she posted a very nice,
very touching
tribute on the Twitter machine yesterday.
And it was talking about how it just romanticized, and I'm not saying romance and anything incestuous, romanticized Michael Madsen, her brother. And in such a way, I would have loved to have said stuff like that. I would have loved to have put those words together because Michael Madsen was really cool.
He was super cool. He was great in this movie. And I can still, you know, however many years later, I could still mimic very badly the Michael Madsen Mr. Blonde dance.
Yes, you were certainly mimicking it very
poorly.
Badly.
Doing very poorly.
Excellent job, very badly. All right, we'll take a break, and we will end our time as the pregame show for Trash Panda by actually bringing Trash Panda into the studio.
See how that works? A little transition action.
Stuck in the middle with you.
Steve Rosenbloom. Mike Esposito on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Yeah, that's us. We are the pregame show for Trash Panda. Adam Studzinski is here on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. We're playing Neil Diamond.
This is a karaoke killer song right here. Today!
No. Sweet Caroline is. They get an entire stadium going bump, bump, bump.
But you get a bunch of drunk people in a bar at like 1 in the morning.
They'll sing to anything. You don't need.
But the chorus of America, I mean, come on. You get the Todays in the background. I mean, it's just. You get me.
Happy,
you feel me out there.
Happy 4th of July for you. Happy Independence Day.
Coming to America. Not a big fan of the Sweet Caroline song, by the way. Not a big fan.
It's great.
Oh, it's
I love
so
it.
Good.
Yeah.
I got. I don't know exactly why, but anyway, finish what you were doing.
No, why?
That's the song that they would play at this one particular bar at closing time in Macomb,
mm-hmm.
at Western. So, and I hated it. I don't know why. I just didn't like it. It wasn't because it was the end of bar time. I mean, that didn't matter in college. It's 2 a.m. You're going to go home and drink more anyway. And I just, for whatever reason, I hated it. Like, I just didn't like it. So I now associate that song with that kind of moment, and I just can't do it. Don't like it.
What an interesting closing time song.
No, and I can tell you, because I used to, back in the day when you actually had to, like, mix music together, like CDs or records, I used to DJ in a bar many moons ago, and mm-hmm. Sweet Caroline is one of those songs that you just automatically put on, and you just kind of let everyone go nuts because they will sing the entire thing, and especially the chorus.
That's what would happen. Yeah. But it would just always be the last song, and then they would play closing time, and then that's when the lights would go on.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Okay. You have PTSD from Western, I think.
I guess. I don't know. The bar was called The Pace. R.I.P. No longer there. That bar was an institution. It was there when my parents were there in the 70s, and it finally got shut down.
And did your whole family throw up on the floor?
I did. I don't know about my parents. I know I did for sure once.
Shooter? He ended up face down?
I don't know. I'd have to ask him. Because it was in a different location when they were there. But I did once. At least once. And didn't get kicked out. Don't know how.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Did they not see you?
I don't know
how
they didn't see me. This was, all right, so now we're deep into it. This wasn't even late at night. This was early evening during their happy hour on Halloween. So I'd been, you know, with friends and pre-gaming for
a week.
God knows how long.
Yeah.
And so we're there, and they had, where the dance floor normally would be during that time of day, they had beer pong and Flippy Cup set up. You guys familiar with Flip Cup?
Yep.
So they had that set up when we were doing that, and I had to release myself in between rounds, and I couldn't make it to the bathroom. Nobody said a word.
Release myself.
Did you make a garbage can, or was it on the floor?
No, it was right on the floor.
Excellent.
I have a question. Are you?
I'm glad that could go public.
There you go.
When it came to Flippy Cups and beer pong, were you as intense and with such ferocity as you are basically just walking into the studio?
No. Not.
No?
The only time that I was really intense about Flip Cup is when on Christmas Eve one year, me and a bunch of my cousins and my aunt and uncle had a girls versus guys tournament. So it was me and a few of my cousins and I think my uncle versus a few of my girl cousins and my aunt. And we had a whole, it was like a tennis setup. It was like best 2 out of 3 to win a set. And we went like 7 sets. It went all the way down to the last game of the last set, and the girls beat us.
There were rules that, and everything.
It was an unfair advantage. I was the only one in college on the guys' side. So they had, I think, 2 or 3 people still in college on their side versus really just me on my side. So they had an unfair advantage, but we still took them to the last game.
So that was the only time you were intense over these kinds of...
That's the only time. Oh, it was so intense.
Because you certainly brought it into the studio on a daily basis.
And this was supposed to be, I remember this, it was supposed to be just a quick, fun thing that we did during halftime of the Notre Dame game. And it turned into like an hour-long extravaganza where we're yelling at one of my cousins, go get more beer. We need more beer down here. Like,
now, did anyone vomit on the Studzinski family floor?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good.
No one vomited on Auntie Cheryl's floor. That would have been a problem.
So your White Sox called up a player. What do you think?
I don't care.
Ladies and gentlemen, White Sox baseball.
Are they not your White Sox anymore?
No, they haven't. Have I not explained this? They're not my White Sox anymore. They have not been for a while. I think the second year of Tony La Russa in May, when that season was really starting to go downhill, that's when I was done. I just walked away. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I don't care enough to put up with this BS. I'm out.
No.
Exactly.
Thank you, Tony.
So there you that was it for me. And I mean, look, Colson Montgomery, I'll talk about it a little bit. I'll believe the White Sox can develop a position player when it happens.
And does
because it hasn't happened.
The guys they traded for from Boston, obviously, you would count as Boston having developed then, right?
And what we're counting them as wins right now because they don't suck. Is that how low the bar is? I don't know if Chase Meyerdorff has been fine. Vargas has been fine, and maybe good to an extent. But show me something more than not sucking.
I agree with you. Meyerdorff and Teal are Boston prospects that the Sox just traded for, and Vargas, if you like him, he's from the Dodgers.
Even that, the White Sox have proven they can ruin Boston prospects. Yeah. Yoan Moncada, is he still
playing on the Angels, right?
Do you realize Yoan Moncada will be in Cubs rumors?
He will be.
For third base.
He will be.
He will be, because the Angels are going to be selling.
Unless Matt Shaw, and I'll get into this in my first segment coming up, unless that walk-off sack fly last night can spark something for Matt Shaw. It was really good at bat.
Yep.
So, I you know what, before we get too far down the line, I have notes from your guys' show that I just want to applaud you on. I get up early to go for a nice morning run before I come in, and I'm listening to the first segment of your guys' show, and I want to applaud you on the quintessential Saturday suckageness of Rosie immediately messing up the phone number, which has been the same for how long? When's the last time, Espo, you guys would know, it predates me.
I have no idea either. I have no idea what the phone number is.
As far as I know, it's never been any different than 312-644-6767.
Uh-huh.
So that was great.
Although I have given out my personal cell phone once or twice.
I got two-thirds of the way through mine once at like 3 a.m. during overnights.
You only give out the phone number correctly if you want phone calls.
That's good point. And immediately after that, the 7.5 minute scoreboard update, beautiful.
Thank
just,
you.
That's very old school.
Thank you.
That is score. That's vintage score.
The only thing it was missing was a traffic update from down here on Lake Street. I think that's the only thing that could have made it better. down here on Lake Street, Lake and Stetson, we got a guy at the stop sign.
Mary DeSantis.
We did get Scott Merkin from LAX Airport. So there you go.
So we'll count that, I guess. And then, of course, Rosie bringing a Bears thought from his cigar guy.
Yeah.
I think that's perfect.
That's it.
And of course, it's a Tyson Bagent thought.
Yeah.
So
right. So there you go. So just, look for it in week five.
Was your cigar guy one of the people who wanted Tyson Bagent to keep starting over Justin Fields in what Dan Bernstein described as the stupidest storyline he's ever been a part of?
I don't know. I don't recall talking to him about that. I just remember this was most recent thing is like, oh, week five. And then Espo and I like, bye week, yeah. That's a good time to change quarterbacks. Go. And the first game would be against the Commanders.
Yep.
When he should have been a legend.
In Washington.
He should have been a legend. Caleb Williams was overcoming an idiot offensive coordinator, an idiot head coach, and an idiot defensive back.
Well, don't forget, he did beat the Packers in Lambeau. Mm-hmm. Caleb did. So that's legendary on its own.
But
it's the first time the Bears have won there in 10 years.
There you go.
The last quarterback that won there was Jay Cutler. Think about that.
Ooh, that's icky. On that note, we're leaving. We're going to go throw up on Auntie Cheryl's floor. That's what we're going to do.
Oh, please don't.
Well, Studs, you have a lot coming up leading into Cubs, I know, right?
Yeah. So a lot of Cubs talk in the first hour here. A lot of stuff coming out of the game from last night. It was a big win for the Cubs in more ways than one. Evan Altman of CubsInsider.com will join us at 11:25.
We like Evan.
Evan's great. Love Evan. Got a lot of stuff I want to talk about with him. If we have time, depending on how our Cubs conversation goes, I have a Bulls analogy that I want to complete from a show I was doing with Rami last week that is an analogy to South Park.
Wow, that's a long tease here from last week's show.
Hey, he's got notes on our 7 a.m. hour. I mean, this is a prepared man here.
And of course, we'll talk some Bears. And before we get out of here, we'll hear some of Craig Council's pregame show leading up to Cubs pre at 12:45.
There you go. That's it.
That's a show, friend.
Adam Studzinski after us. Thank you for tolerating us this Independence Day. You now have your independence. From Rosenblum and Esposito, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.